here on KGRA Radio. Welcome to the Richard Dolan Show, where every week we fight the good fight. Haven't been here in a few weeks. It's now May 29th, 2017. Happy to be here with you all. Not working off of my standard microphone, but I think Race is going to make me sound as well as I possibly can, given the constraints of working with me to begin with. But I'm looking forward to a good show here with you tonight. I want to start off just by I've got a pretty involved program for tonight, but I want to start with what I guess I've been looking at as the ufology wars. And there's a lot going on in the field of the UFO research. And I guess the first thing I just want to start off by mentioning is the comment, a bit belatedly, on the recent statements by former MUFON Pennsylvania State Director John Venturi, a very unfortunate and wrong and ignorant rant, is the only word that I can say about it, against black people. It just was the worst thing for me to read what he wrote. I didn't see it right away. In the first place, I've stepped away from social media quite a bit over the past year or more. And in the second place, I've been traveling. And then I heard rumors that he had said something very divisive, very controversial, very wrong. And finally read it, and I was horrified, honestly, by, impertinent, wrong-headed, and also off-topic kinds of comments coming out of someone of a supposed position of responsibility in an organization that all of us in the field of UFO research want to believe in. We want MUFON to do well. And here's MUFON with a state director just shooting his mouth off in a totally ignorant way. So I saw that my very good friend and published author Ryan Sprague made a very forthright and proper statement about this. A lot of other people came in, Kathleen Martin, James Clarkson, and quite a few others. And Race Hobbs, Race, can I have you just chime in here for a minute? Is this something that you want to talk about or not?
I have no dog in this hunt, but, I'll be glad to answer any questions or anything, you need me to comment on.
Well, I mean, look, you and I talked about this earlier in the week, and I don't want to put you in a situation where you want to say something you don't want to say or anything like that. But I know your opinions, they're in line with my own, and I just want to say that I'm very glad that Jan Harzan fired Venturi from his position. John Venturi had no business, after a statement like that, being in charge of anything to do with MUFON.
Yes, I really appreciate Jan Harzan for who he is. He's a very kind and very brilliant and bright gentleman. My problem came, Richard, honestly, when this went public. It was my opinion that he should have removed him from state director right then and made a very clear and decisive, comment, right, and a statement to the public about, denouncing this kind of activity and will not be acceptable and move on. But he didn't. And I'm sort of, kind of connected with people behind the scenes as I was in MUFON, and I realized this. Me and the director of investigations went through the code of ethics line by line to try to find something to arm MUFON, to remove him from MUFON with. There's no language there. However, the one good thing, well, there's a few good things to come out of this, but one good thing to come out of this is that that language is being placed in the new state director manuals that will be distributed at the MUFON symposium in July. And the second good thing about it was, he was finally removed after many people in MUFON and that worked with MUFON had jumped ship or threatened to jump ship. I mean, it was finally the people had spoken, and I think the MUFON leadership was forced then to act. Because many people didn't get a hold of this until a week and a half later after that it had broke, because social media was really the force that drove this home. and that there's no room for such bigotry in right. anywhere, not just in ufology, but anywhere.
Right. Absolutely.
And to add to that, honestly, it was the day that I resigned from MUFON after 10 years of service to the volunteer in a voluntary service to the organization. I resigned that day. MUFON Radio was pulled from the KGRE lineup due to a lack of response from the leadership of MUFON at 9 a.m. that morning. And then at around 5, 6 o'clock that evening, I got a call from one of the people at MUFON saying that they had just gotten off the phone with Jan and that Jan had just removed John Ventry from the state director job.
Well, it had to be done. I'm very glad he did it. MUFON doesn't need people like that representing them. And in fact, you those interested in UFO research don't need people like that representing us in any way. So I'm happy we're done with that. Let's move on. I don't want MUFON to put itself in a position of having state directors just shooting themselves off that way and embarrassing the organization, embarrassing everyone else. With remarks that, I mean, here's the last thing I want to say about this, and I want to move on to another major controversy that's going on in this field. Those of us interested in UFOs, in theory, are interested in the possibility or likelihood of alien life, right? And I honestly don't understand how there could be people in the UFO field who, or at least profess to be in the UFO field and profess to be interested in this subject, and are still dividing humans by their race and color. I don't get it. This seems to me the most wrongheaded, backward, backthinking. There's no place for it in my world. Freedom of speech, go for it, say what you want, but you're not part of an organization that I want to be involved with. I'm not even a member of MUFON, but I don't want people like that representing the field that I'm working in. There's just no place for it. So I'm glad that Jan did what he did, and I'm glad that John Ventry is not part of the MUFON leadership anymore. I understand he still has a membership in MUFON. I don't know what they're going to do about that. And the only other thing I guess I'll say is, and this will segue me into my next theme, and that might take me into the next segment as well, which are my thoughts on the controversial aspects of the secret space program and claims thereof. I'm just going to say this. I had been unofficially banned from MUFON Symposium for 6 years. They can say what they want, but I know it's true. It's true. And I know I've got this directly from several people who were there on the spot, and they overheard conversations by the former MUFON director, Clifford Cliff, about how angry he was that I made comments in 2011 about MUFON's need to reform itself and become more transparent and so forth. By the way, my lecture there was on the secret space program. That was back in 2011 I was talking about this. But I was banned unofficially for 6 years from MUFON for saying what I did. I didn't care. I was happy to be banned for that reason. And in fact, I'll tell you this, and I'll say this to anyone at MUFON, and if Jan hears me, that's fine too. I would have been happy to be banned for life from MUFON symposiums because I don't care that much. I do my work. My work matters to me. But it also matters that, I mean, I want to have as good relationships with other professional people in this field as I can. So here I was coming back in 2017 at the symposium in Las Vegas this coming July. And not only was I very disturbed by the fact that MUFON's symposium this year was focusing on what I feel are very dubious claims by individuals who have claimed to be in the so-called secret space program, something that I believe exists, a secret space program. But I've been very skeptical about some of these individuals, and all of them seem to have been brought in at once to the MUFON symposium. So I was disturbed enough about that, and I'm going to be talking more about that in a moment. But then this whole thing happened with Ventry's absurd, ridiculous statement, and I thought, are they just trying to make this impossible for me to come back and speak there after 6 years? Honestly, I thought, what is going on here? But Jan did the right thing, and he made it so that I'm still on board to be going there. I feel it's important that I go to MUFON.
Yeah, because you almost bailed out.
Yeah, this, I was That's true. I was ready just to walk a few weeks ago, and you know this, and a few other people know this, and I was just ready to say the hell with it. I don't want to do this. It's not worth it. It's not worth it for the hassle and everything else. But I am going, and I committed myself to going. I'm going to stand by my commitment.
That's the biggest. You know, I want to thank John Venturi for throwing all of the fine folks that do the work in MUFON under the bus, because that's exactly what he did. You know, he didn't. He didn't, well, you know, he hurt the MUFON organization overall with membership. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of people that are displeased with MUFON out there who have taken hold of this and just ran with it.
But, well, that's the thing. MUFON is in the crosshairs of a lot of people, not just MUFON, ufology in general.
Right,
is
right.
In the crosshairs of many people who are just looking for the slightest excuse to just anything. Take another shot. And the adventure just handed it to them on a silver platter.
And there are many fine people, Richard. Just want to jump in and say this really quickly. There are many fine people in the organization of MUFON who do really good work. They work very hard. They're very diligent. And they're very honorable and trustworthy. And those are the ones who are left, you know, to deal with the mob, so to speak, to deal with the people down on the ground that are throwing and levying all these accusations. And they're the ones. You know, so it takes quick and decisive leadership sometimes to be able to support your membership and to support your volunteers. And, you know, Richard, when I held my hand out, what do I have left to give MUFON? What do they have left to give me? The balance was zero. So it was, I was just ready to go. I didn't want to polish another turd. That's just how it went. And so many other people did. You know, Nick Redfern, Richard, left. He's no longer a contributor.
I know. Yes, I know.
You know, and so many others. But it's just unfortunate because there are so many people out there waiting for just a little nugget of anything that they can jump on. I have seen more people come out of the woodwork and chime in on this that I haven't heard from and seen from in so long. I thought that they were gone from the movement all together, and it's just like everybody and their brother has jumped on this to come out and get some clicks and get some notoriety, trying to act like they're standing up for something.
Part of the problem is, I mean, MUFON, I mean, I know Jan has done his best to remake MUFON into something that's a bit more responsive to the members. Mm-hmm. 6 years ago, when I spoke at the symposium, it was in July of 2011, the one that got me banned, which, by the way, I took 10 minutes of what I said there and I put it on YouTube. It's actually – it's very tame. It's very, but in the context of that conference, it was not tame. If you want to Google it on YouTube, I think it says something like Richard Dolan speaking on the future of ufology, and you can find it. And this was actually what got me banned for 6 years from MUFON's symposium. What I said there was, among other things, I said if MUFON doesn't realize, but MUFON can very easily be superseded if it is not responsive to its members, if it does not engage in the very people who are part of it and make them feel that they're actually – that they matter, and rather than just be subscribers to the MUFON Journal, which is really how the previous leadership, Clifford Clift, had characterized it. And I know for a fact he did because he said it to me. I said MUFON's got to do much more in making its members recognize that the leadership is responsive to them. This is back in 2011. This is how I met Chase Kletsky, by the way. Chase was one of the important, let's call them whistleblowers about MUFON. Another one was the late Elaine Douglas, who I knew fairly well for years. Elaine has passed away.
Wow.
James Clarkson was another person who spoke out at this time, all on Jerry Pippin's show, incidentally. I hope that they're available somewhere. But all of these people talked about how MUFON was lacking transparency. And Chase went on the record and said she had been the star team manager at MUFON. She said there was not a single investigation at MUFON that had not been compromised at the highest levels. She said that. So there was a lot to go on. And I made the point back then to speak about it. And I said, look, if MUFON does not do something quickly to turn this ship around, there will come a day when it goes away really fast. It'll happen suddenly without anyone expecting it. Another organization will come or something will happen and MUFON will be obsolete. And I said it right on that stage. And I don't want that to happen to MUFON because I believe that there's value in the organization. There's always been value in the organization. It's for much of its history, when it was led by Walter Andrus, for all those years, it was unactualized potential. That organization just sat and really did next to nothing. When the internet exploded in the 1990s, MUFON did nothing. And years went by and nothing seemed to happen. The reports never seemed to go anywhere. And then John Schuessler came in, and I liked John, but he just wasn't in a position to turn things around. Then James Carrion came on, and the organization became even more divided after that, when they basically had a director who didn't even believe in UFOs, essentially. And MUFON just never got itself on the right foot. And many of us looking at it always felt that Jan was the guy, he could do it. And I'm still holding out hope that he can do it. I'm waiting. Everyone likes Jan Harzan, and it's not hard to see why. He's got integrity, he's smart, he knows the subject, and I believe he really wants to do what's best for MUFON and for ufology. So we're just going to keep – I'm going to keep hoping. I'm not giving up on MUFON, and I'm glad that I'm going to symposium. Now, I just want to segue. Enough of the racist ridiculousness of Venturi, and let's move on. I just came back from the conference known as Contact in the Desert in Joshua Tree, California. And I realize people who don't go to these conferences have very strong opinions about it. I will just say straight out, I actually love going to Joshua Tree. It's a little crazy. There's opinions of all types that are expressed there, but I personally enjoy the experience of going there, meeting the people, the attendees, the speakers. I've done this now for 4 or 5 years. I don't know how many, but it's always been a positive experience for me. But then again, I've been in this field long enough to accept and recognize that the people who attend UFO related conferences are of all types. And for me, that's fine. But at that conference was Corey Good, who has talked now prominently about his alleged participation in a secret space program. Michael Sala was there, and I've known Michael for many years. Michael promotes Corey Good and people like Bill Tompkins, who wasn't there, but another person who has claimed to have had connection with the so-called secret space program. So this was a huge thing being discussed at Contact in the Desert, and it's been discussed now. It's almost dominated the field of ufology for several years. And I try to look at my own place in this whole thing, because I've been talking and writing about a probable secret space program for many years. My lecture on it in 2011 is available on YouTube. And I did another lecture in 2014, I believe, in San Mateo. I mean, my goodness, I developed the concept of a breakaway civilization back in 2009 when I published Volume 2 of UFOs in the National Security State.
Yep.
So I've been there.
Sure did. Right? Yeah, you sure did. That's something that I'm very proud of you for.
Thank you. So my point is, I have been speculating for a long time about the strong likelihood of a clandestine advanced space program connected in one way or another to the UFO phenomenon. In the research that I've been doing on this for years, I've looked at a number of points of entry into this and why I believe it. A, I believe in the reality of a variety of crash retrievals of UFOs, so that I believe for a long time that there have been secret technology programs. These are going to have to lead somewhere, and clearly one of the things that such programs would be dealing with would be propulsion and what we might call field propulsion, anti-gravity, things related to this, which would presumably get us easily out of the Earth's atmosphere. So that's one thing. There's another line of reasoning. When you look at space-based video anomalies, not all anomalies of space-based UFOs are legit, in my opinion. Many are not. Many actually are ice crystal, but others aren't, in my view, at least in my view. And so I've seen enough of those to make me conclude that there are objects in Earth orbit that are doing things that are not supposed to be possible, and yet there they are, So that's evidence of something going on in space that would, if we're building it, that would be proof right off the bat that there's a secret space program. But even if they're not ours, it would be a strong indication, I've always argued, that we would have a clandestine response to it that would constitute a secret space program. There's the hacking, we don't call it hacking, the experience of Gary McKinnon, I don't want to say he hacked, he didn't really do any hacking, but he was able to gain access to websites of U.S. Space Command and related and found what he thought was evidence of a secret space program. There's the statements of earlier whistleblowers like Carl Wolf and Donna Hare, who've talked explicitly about this. I don't need to be convinced that there's something going on. And there's so much more that when I seek to compile the evidence of a secret space program, I don't need to be convinced it's happening. So when I come to people like Andrew Basciago, Corey Good, Bill Tompkins, Randy Kramer, and other people who similarly make claims that they have gone to Mars, for example, that they have encountered alien creatures like blue avians, as Corey Good has said, that are very tall, and that furthermore, when they make claims that they've gone for 20 years for such a program and then come back, but you unfortunately can't check their claims because they were time regressed back to their moment of departure, and even mom didn't know he was gone, and so it makes it impossible to check such claims. I mean, look, people making these types of claims, I'm not here to have wars with anyone, but they must recognize that these are not credible claims. Now, before I go one step further, I want to just say something. So I have also personally met with alleged whistleblowers. One in particular I just recently was chatting with, who has made even a similar claim. Secret space program, asked to go for a long period of time in space. I don't have an opinion on this particular whistleblower that I've just chatted with, and I think he's a good guy. I think he's honest. He seems honest to me. This is someone who actually has provided a DD-214 to me and has provided a variety of other pieces of evidence to indicate to me that he is who he says he is. So that's a step up. But that still doesn't make me conclude just yet that he is exactly accurate. And I will just add that this particular whistleblower that I've spoken to has very much more modest claims of what he can remember than someone like Corey Good or someone like Andrew Basciago, for that matter, or Randy Kramer. Those people have very explicit, detailed memories of extended periods of time, allegedly on another planet. This individual that I'm talking to, if I ever even reveal his identity, I don't know. He has no such detailed memories. But he has certain interesting anomalies that make me wonder. Let's talk some more. What I want to say is this. I will never criticize another researcher for wanting to dive into these claims to investigate them. No matter how outrageous they may seem to those of us out there who may not believe them, and they may indeed, very likely that many of these claims are not true. But if there are researchers out there who want to go in and try to confirm and to test, let them do it. And I think that's great. They should try to do it. On the other side of it, there need to be good researchers who are going to be critiquing these and looking for the holes in the stories. I have a little bit more to say about this, and I'm going to continue this after the break, by the way. But the one thing that I just want people to know from my point of view, all right, one thing that I will never do is get into personal wars with people. I'm just not going to do it. And I'm not going to get into a war with Corey Good. I'm not going to get into a war with Michael Sala. I'm not going to get into a war with Andrew Basciago or Bill Tompkins or Randy Kramer. I have no interest in getting personal with any of these people. For me, if I'm going to have a critique, It will be concerning the accuracy of their claims or the quality of their research. If, in the case of someone like Michael, who's not really making claims himself, but he's researching and trying to corroborate these people's claims. Any of the statements that people make is up for grabs. Most recently, there's been a lot of talk about these wars in ufology, Corey Good versus people like Bill Ryan, who's a friend of mine, and myself. I've been brought into this. I know Dark Journalist over on YouTube. I've done interviews with him. He's making a lot out of this right now. Basically, from my point of view, that's fine. I just want to make sure that my points of view are accurately characterized. All right. And incidentally, I have a lot of respect for the people over at Project Avalon who are looking into this matter with a great deal of attention and care. Bill Ryan has run Avalon, and I'm good friends with one of the moderators there as well. And I respect really most of the contributors there. I like to look at it from time to time. So they're on top of this. They're very critical of the story of Corey Good. It's important and it's fair game to be critiquing these people. I just, for my part, I don't want to get personal. I'm not interested in having, because I feel like when we go down the personal road, all right, we're missing the point. I didn't get involved in UFO research because I was interested in the personalities of the researchers in doing this. I have no interest in that. Never did. I'm interested in the subject. I'm interested in getting answers to this mystery and exploring it. I have a lot more to say about this. It may cut into some of the other things I wanted to say tonight, but that's fine. We're really at the bottom of the hour. So how about we do this? Let me take a quick break. I'm going to come back in 3 or 4 minutes, and we will pick this up. I'm Richard Dolan here on The Richard Dolan Show, KGRA Radio. We'll be right back. So I'm back. I just want to have about 5 or 10 more minutes on this whole theme. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my thoughts on a secret space program. Again, I think it's real. There have been many good leaks over the years, too many indicators from what we know of from our classified history. Yes, there is one. There is a secret space program. The question that I have been asking myself is how far advanced is it? All right. So one question we might ask is, have we actually secretly traversed the solar system? If you go back to the Brad Sorenson ARV story from 1988, you might conclude that, yes, we have. I've studied that account as well as anyone that I know. I've not met Brad Sorenson, but I know a number of people who interviewed him carefully. I am friends with Mark McCandlish, who was Brad Sorenson's friend back in 88, who got the story firsthand. Essentially, Brad Sorenson went on to an air show in 1988 at Lockheed Hellendale's facility. He was actually flown to it from the air show with a high-ranking defense official, very high-ranking. They went into a hangar, the big hangar at Lockheed, guarded by soldiers with M-16s. It was a very surprisingly secure area. The official said to Brad, "Don't say anything. I'll get you in. Just keep your lips sealed." And they went in, and on another one side of the hangar behind a curtain were three hovering craft looking essentially like flying saucer type craft. They were hovering. Sorenson talked about this. He said, look, he was absolutely at his most alert. There were no ropes suspending these things, nothing like that. There was a four-star general talking about them, referring to them as ARV, alien reproduction vehicles, and indicating that they had traveled the solar system. So now you can take the story and believe it or not. I believe that I believe it. I think that I do. There are other interesting leaks and stories that are similar to Sorensen's that make me think, yeah, we probably, as crazy as this might sound to someone who hasn't gone into the subject, I do believe that we've developed propulsion-type technology and craft that have left Earth's orbit and are much better than the kinds of technologies NASA officially is working on. So that's one thing. I believe that. So in propulsion, possibly in energy, the classified world could be very significantly advanced from where we are, and I think they probably are. Now let's look at some other areas. Genetics. Well, in terms of genetics, I don't really profess to know. I have not gotten any what I feel are credible leaks from the classified world that make me think that they've gone into similarly way, way far advanced breakthroughs in genetics as they have in propulsion. It's possible that they have, but I personally have not encountered credible sources that make me think that they have. So in other words, major breakthrough in genetics could indicate virtual immortality. I don't know that that's been achieved. I don't think it's been achieved. David Rockefeller just died a few months ago. He's 101 years old. Zbigniew Brzezinski, another of the masters of the universe, died the other day at age 89. They may be living on the blood of 10-year-old children, for all I know, but they don't seem to be benefiting from a cracked genetic code that allows immortality. So if someone's benefiting from it, it's not those guys. I suspect that we have not, even in the classified world, made the ultimate profound breakthrough in genetics that may be coming. CRISPR technology, even in our official world, is making ridiculously rapid advances. Then there's quantum computing, then there's AI, and there's nanotech. This is a huge question. Where has the classified world gone with AI? Again, no one knows. Nobody knows this. I remember a couple of years ago reading a musing by James Bamford, who is an expert on the NSA, wrote several books on the NSA. Bamford, I think it was maybe 3 years ago, said there's a maybe 50-50 chance, if I recall him correctly, said that the NSA had advanced quantum computing. But he didn't know either. Nobody knows. And then there's advanced AI. Have they, in the classified world, hit the singularity? My suspicion is no. I suspect that they have not done it. Just because, in other words, that there is a probable breakaway civilization doesn't mean that they have created magic in every aspect of their civilization. I think that's unlikely. My suspicion all along is that they're very advanced in some ways and maybe marginally advanced in others. Nanotech, same thing. Then we come down to space-time mastery. And again, all I can do is speculate because, you know what, I don't know any better than the next person. Have people within the deep black classified world mastered space-time to the extent that they can jump through time or go through wormholes or, master Miguel Alcubierre's equations of essentially of a warp drive type of propulsion? Has any of that happened? I don't know. I actually don't think so, but I'm not willing to rule it out. I say I don't think so because, again, to my satisfaction, I have not yet met a credible individual with alleged inside information that gives me reason to think that they've done it. So I'm not seeing true space-time mastery. I spoke to a gentleman retired from Boeing. I've talked about this once in a while. I know this man. I know his wife. These are good people. He's a real guy. He's a real retired engineer from Boeing who told me that Boeing was working on black triangles in the 90s and in the 80s and that they were working with reverse engineered ET tech and that they had not fully mastered that technology. To me, he's a credible man. And I'm willing to believe him. But that's a long way off from space-time mastery and time compression and all of these other things. So my take on this is that there is almost certainly a breakaway civilization of sorts. The question remains, how far and in what ways have they broken away from us? Are they very advanced, or are they essentially living a magical existence where they can do anything, including reverse time travel? There are people like Mr. Corey Good and like Mr. Randy Kramer and like Mr. Andrew Bastiago. And again, I'm not here to trash these people. I'm not interested in doing that. I've met two of the three. I've met Corey Good and I've met Andrew Bastiago. And I just want to say this about Andy. He's a very nice person. Actually liked meeting him. He's a very decent human being. And Corey Good was nothing if not polite to me. I have nothing personal against these individuals. That includes Randy Kramer as well, who I have not yet met. But so I'm not here to trash people. I don't do wars with people. But I want to come back to UFO evidence in general. When we're working this field, people are saying, making claims one way or the other. What we researchers need, and those of us who take this subject seriously, we need evidence that's verifiable. It's really that simple. I'm not that interested in a good campfire story, which is what some of these constitute. And I don't mean to demean them, but if you're providing a story that cannot possibly be corroborated with outside information, then it is literally technically unfalsifiable. What that means in philosophy is you can't prove it true or false. It's therefore not valid argumentation. It might be true. Something can be true even if it's not valid, philosophically speaking, scientifically speaking. And maybe, just maybe, what these guys are saying is true. But the problem that I have as a researcher is I have no way as yet to confirm these stories. The piling on effect doesn't do it for me. In other words, just because another person says it and then another person says it, sorry, but that doesn't constitute evidence for me because it can't be independently corroborated outside that circle. I mean, one thing I said, I think it was on Jimmy Church when he did a guest on Coast 6-8 months ago, something like that. I said, look, if I were interested in sowing disinformation in this field, it'd be the easiest thing in the world. I could spend 6 months studying the subject, learning the claims that are out there, some of the outrageous claims, and then I could just formulate my own story and then present it, and there'd always be someone willing to video me and put me out there and make me into the next star. And it would be easy to do. It would be easy to lay waste to the field, particularly if there's a genuine secret space program that does exist that needs to be protected, right? If you're in charge of security of a genuine, real clandestine space program, and you want to make sure that it remains protected at least for another 10 years or more or whatever, you're going to bring in disinformation. You're going to bring in people who will steer researchers the wrong way, who will steer the public the wrong way, and who will also, in the process, bring discredit to the subject, to the general public, which all of those individuals have done, whether they mean to or not. That's what has happened. So from a disinformation intelligence community point of view, these stories have a certain smell to them. It doesn't mean that they're definitely not true yet. Again, I want to point out, I will always support researchers who are doing their best to investigate these claims one way or the other. I have no problem with anyone doing that, and that includes Michael Sala. If he's going to do that, I just want him to do a good job with it. I spoke with Michael a few days ago when I was in the California desert, and I believe he is sincere. I believe he really wants to do a good job. The question remains, are these claims genuine, and can anything be done with them? My take on this now, and this is at this point what I will say at MUFON when I'm there in Las Vegas in July, is that these claims do not pass the evidence test, and they don't pass the smell test. That doesn't mean that we can't research it, but we need to be careful about this stuff. Last thing I want to say, although I'm not here to trash people, I don't want to do wars with people, I do want to say when people are out there clearly trying to make money from their claims, we have a right to question their motivations. And they can try to defend their motivations, and they are allowed to defend their motivations all they want. My attitude is you're absolutely allowed to make money in doing what you want to do. And if you are able to sell books or stories to people who are willing to buy them, that is your right to do it. And I'm the last person to try to take that right away from you. Now, when it damages my field of research, I also am allowed to question you. So, and so are other people. Last thing I want to say on this is distinguishing because I don't want to be divisive here. I know there are people out there who want me to fight some war on one side of this. And I don't want to do that. I want us to all to be better than that. First of all, I don't want to attack a person because whatever I may think privately about someone is not germane to the public discussion. Secondly, all too many times in my life when I have seen anyone personally being trashed, it is usually based on insufficient knowledge by the person doing it. And I don't want to do that. Third, going after people is usually a waste of time. I prefer to stick to the issues, not to the people. And fourth, I mean, most important, I just want to say in this field, ideas and people are totally different things. When we're dealing with ideas, those ideas, any ideas, are there to be critiqued. That's what it's about, whether it's about UFOs or about religion or about a belief system of any sort. Ideas are fair game to be critiqued. People are different. And unfortunately, in this field of ufology and everything related to it, there are folks out there who really love, they get off on attacking other individuals and starting personal wars. And it's not helpful. It's really not helpful. So I think we're all best served by sticking to the subject matter that brought us all in here to begin with, which is frankly the most amazing, fascinating mystery that I can possibly imagine. The mystery of unidentified flying objects that are clearly being recorded, that are not supposed to exist, but do exist. And furthermore, the likelihood that that phenomenon is related to the presence of some other that is, in my view, here interacting with us in some important way. And furthermore, to the mystery that this phenomenon of UFOs is almost certainly related to the existence of a secret space program, a clandestine space program that does exist. These are genuine mysteries, genuine areas of public policy that we should be researching. But when we start getting stuck on personalities, we're derailing ourselves from what really matters. So again, I just want to say, attack the ideas, not the person. As for unity in ufology, I'm not really a big proponent one way or the other about unity. The ufology has never been unified, never. And that's not the worst thing in the world. Politics, we're never unified. That's the price of having a free society with different opinions. I mean, my goodness, if you have a truly unified society, that's called totalitarianism and fascism. And I'll opt out. Thank you very much. So I don't really need, I don't have this need for unity. But I do want to recognize that we, those of us in this field, we are a community. We constitute a community. And we can be civil to each other. We can be polite to each other. And we can support each other in a spirit of goodwill. And I do believe that. I don't have to agree with everyone in this field for me to respect where they're coming from. It's not necessary. Because if I were only to respect those people that I agree with, first of all, it's a really lousy way to live your life. Secondly, it's probably an unwise way to live my life because I can't believe that I'm right about every single thing at this point in time that I believe in. I'm sure that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or less, I will discover that I've been wrong about certain things and I'll have to revise my opinion. So it's really foolish of me and really wrongheaded of me to judge someone else based on whether or not they agree with all of my opinions. There are folks out there who are like this, and I wish that that were not the case. What we need to recognize, I feel, is we can disagree with somebody, and if they are honest about where they're coming from, then we can still disagree with them and respect them. If, however, we encounter individuals who really are taking advantage of the gullibility of individuals or are taking advantage of some other aspect of this field in order to make money, become superstars, whatever, then yes, we have the right to call them out, and we have the right particularly to critique their ideas, even more than calling them out. Go after the ideas. Because you never really know. There could be down the road, we may discover some truly bizarre reality buried in the claims of these people. How difficult is it to recognize, for example, that some or many of these individuals have been messed with in one way or another? It's totally possible. I have spoken to military witnesses, several, who I know for a fact have been screwed with psychologically through drugs that were administered by military agencies and intelligence agencies. This has happened, not simply the guys in the Rendlesham Forest incident either. I've spoken personally to other individuals, and I know absolutely that the United States military black budget community will drug people and screw with their heads and mess up their memories and manage their memories. The easiest way to hide something is to package it in utter nonsense and then put it out there. So again, is it possible? Is it just possible that some of these claims that are out there circulating have a grain of truth? Well, I'm not willing to say yes or no. I am willing to question the veracity of these individuals. And I guess I'll add one other thing, which is that, you know, in a field that is in the crosshairs of so many people, I do personally think that researchers and alleged whistleblowers, I would like them to have an obligation to comport themselves in a way that is a little bit more professional and a little bit more amenable to genuine critique. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. So these are some of my thoughts on the whole lack of unity, the whole argument that's taking place now relating to an alleged secret space program. And I'm going to be seeing these people directly in about 2 months in Las Vegas, and I'm going to sit down at a panel with them, and I'm going to be in front of an audience with them. And I'm sure that I will have a very different opinion on matters than they collectively will have. And ultimately, it's not necessary for me to take down anyone or to destroy anyone or anything like that. What I will simply want to do is to point out, what is the evidence? What is acceptable evidence here? Not one guy's story, not another guy's story. What is the actual evidence that is available for those of us outsiders to critique and to analyze? And if there isn't anything there, then the fact is that those individuals do not yet have the right to be called genuine whistleblowers. Because this is the last thing I want to say about whistleblowers. A whistleblower is someone that you know who they are. You can confirm who they are. They have a genuine background that can be investigated. They have a story that, even if you can't prove the story, you can at least investigate them. I don't know anyone who has investigated the families of these various whistleblowers that I've been talking about. If there have been investigations of them, then I have to plead ignorance, and I probably ought to know, and I don't know, and I apologize. But I'm not aware of anyone doing detailed investigations of the families of these individuals. That would be a start. You know, what we want with our so-called whistleblowers is a way to confirm who they are. William Binney is a whistleblower. That man's a double amputee and an American hero who got pulled out of the shower by FBI agents at gunpoint because of what he said about NSA. He's a whistleblower. All right. Edward Snowden is a whistleblower. Gary McKinnon is a whistleblower because we know who he is. We know the U.S. government was after him and tried to throw him into Gitmo for years. He qualifies, in my view. All right. You have to have a background that can be confirmed. That's step one. And after that, we can take it step one step at a time.
Richard, how would you classify Julian Assange?
Well, Julian Assange is someone who facilitates whistleblowers. Right? So he is the face of WikiLeaks. I personally am a very strong supporter of Julian Assange. Not everyone is. I am. And I'm not going to veer from that. I think he's doing a great service. But he himself, personally, I don't think qualifies as a whistleblower. But what he does through WikiLeaks is he is a magnet for whistleblowers, and he vets whistleblowers to the extent that he can and so forth. So that's what he is.
You know, I think that he has created the most honest news outlet in today's society.
Well, I agree with you. No one has ever yet shown WikiLeaks to have one single misstep, that they've done one single thing that's wrong. WikiLeaks has always been honest. They've always been upfront. They've never screwed up. So I agree with you. I think they're ultra reliable. And when the CIA wants to argue with WikiLeaks, who are you going to believe? I'm believing WikiLeaks every single time. CIA is a pack of liars. So, for example, this whole nonsense, which I'm going to talk about later in this program on the Russian hack. I mean, I've talked about this so many times. The nonsensical, ridiculous, foolish, absurd Russian hack that never happened. And WikiLeaks says, you know, Russia did not hack the American elections. Who are you going to believe? I'm believing WikiLeaks. Every time I'll believe WikiLeaks over the CIA, which never tells the truth. But I'm going to come back to that in a later segment of this program. Something's going to have to get cut because I spent two segments on the unfortunate problems of ufology, and we have them. So again, the main takeaway I want people out there to know, whether they're the good people on Avalon or the people who might listen to Dark Journalist or people who are on the other side of it who support these individuals who made these claims, I'm not here to take anyone down at this point. I'm really not. I'm here to say that we ought to have standards of evidence before we move forward with claims. We are allowed to critique these claims, and let's try not to keep it personal. I mean, that's the main thing that I guess I would say here. Let's keep it respectful and professional, and we'll all be happier in the long run. So with that, I'm at the top of the hour. We're going to take a quick break. I will come back. I have to decide what I'm going to talk about and what I'm going to cut from the program. And we got an hour to go. I'm Richard Dolan here on KGRA. We'll be right back. I want to wish everyone a happy Memorial Day, incidentally, in the United States. That's an important holiday. And for those people who have died in American military conflicts, that is why we have Memorial Day. People do give their lives for things that are important. And, you know, you don't have to be a supporter of the American military machine, what it does globally. I don't support that. But I know too many, many, many people who have served in the United States military, and they do it for, you know, for good reasons, most of them. And over time, many people have died. And so that's why we have this day, and I hope that you've had a good Memorial Day. And so I just want to get that out. And the other thing I just want to say about the last thing I want to say about this whole situation with Corey Good and Bill Tompkins and so forth is, look, I feel that I want to defend this field of UFO research and that I want to help defend us as a community and as a unit. And that is why I want and need evidence for claims that are promoted. And that is why I need to have high standards for incredible claims about this subject. You know, years and years ago, it was Carl Sagan who said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I always thought Sagan had a bit of duplicity about that statement when he talked about it in relation to UFOs, because I believe he knew much more than he was letting on. Occasionally, relating to Sagan's remark, I would say that an extraordinary phenomenon requires an extraordinary investigation, which I feel is what UFO subject requires. But it is true that extraordinary claims ought to have powerful evidence and also a good investigation, so both sides of that are valid. again, as I will just finally conclude here, I want people on both sides of this to investigate these claims, because it's very possible that there will be fruitful areas of investigation, however you want to look at it. This is my opinion. At the same time, I will say I wish that some people would not jump on board so rapidly, so willingly to accept claims that do not have evidence. We need to hold to a better standard. At least I have to say I have to hold myself to a higher standard. And if anyone out there cares about what I think in this field, then I feel it's important that they understand where I'm coming from. Evidence is what it's about. And as my dad always has said, my dad, I just saw him today. Tracy and I visited him earlier today. He's retired, living in Florida. My dad was a tough cop for years and always said, money talks, bullshit walks. Anyone can talk, but if you don't have anything to say, then you can just walk. What I would say as a variation of that is money does talk. That is, in other words, if you've got evidence, then absolutely. But if you don't have evidence, then prove it. Bring it out. Help the rest of us. Help us understand. Help us, those of us who want to get evidence for this, you got to give us something to work with. And if you don't give us something to work with, don't expect outsiders to believe you. Okay, end of story. That's it. That's it. So I have a few other things I want to talk about today. I had had a section. I've been thinking about this idea of living in the fake world. Not sure how much of this I want to go into now, but think of it this way. We've talked about fake news. We hear about this all the time. And of course, as we know, I don't need to remind you, but I'm going to remind you anyway. 90% of what you watch, what you listen to, what you read is likely owned by six companies in this world. 30 years ago, 90% of the media was held by 50 different companies. Now it's six. Have you been paying attention? I hope so. All mergers, buyouts, that's what it does. It gets, it's now we're down to six major companies until the next one's bought out. We have a situation of Google dominating 65% of all search engine marketing. Google is now filtering out websites and news that it considers unreliable. They've got algorithms in place. They've got a 10,000-strong workforce that monitors the news looking for hoaxes, misleading websites, what they think are misleading websites, and what they call low-quality content. So they're the new nannies telling you what you're supposed to listen to and what you're supposed to believe. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't need anyone doing that work for me. I'll do it myself. Thanks a lot. Algorithms increasingly are controlling what people are being told and how they interact with the world around them. Then there's Facebook, same story. Google and Facebook dominate digital advertising revenue worldwide. And they are dominating all advertising growth as well. They are managing, monitoring, filtering, censoring news. And that's just them. And then you've got the major news organizations, you've got the major entertainment, all the media coming our way, which is designed not to inform you, but to indoctrinate you. That's what, it's all about indoctrination. Same thing with education. The education field is not about education, it's about indoctrination. All right? Several things here. First of all, young people, generally speaking, and I don't mean to criticize young people, but I've met very few who really know much of anything. I don't think the education system in the United States is very impressive. I don't know what else to say about that. But of course, there's a reason education is so bad, and I've been talking about this for years. I'm not the first. When you have a society in which everything's being scooped out, opportunities being thrown out the window, there are no opportunities the way that there once were, not for a large number of people. In such a situation, you cannot have a broadly well-educated public without there being problems, without being people being unsatisfied and unhappy. What you need is a public that's ill-educated, ill-informed, wasting their time with nonsensical entertainment that doesn't go anywhere and so forth. So that's one problem. That's why one reason education is so bad. But then you look at higher education, and it's really not any better. I think higher education is nothing more than a four-year training program for students to become grad students and professors. Most of the education in four-year universities is so unbelievably ivory towerish academic. First of all, the research and writing, the writing of academics has gotten worse, not better, over the years. And all I would say to you, if you doubt me, is go look for an academic journal article from, say, 1950 or 1960 and compare it with something written today. The quality of the writing is measurably better in earlier decades. It has gotten worse and worse and worse to the point where frequently today it's actually unreadable. I mean, truly unreadable. These are academicians. These people are just speaking to themselves. It's a big, big echo chamber. It's been this way for the last 50 years or so. So the education system is also, generally speaking, it's essentially fake in the sense that, you know, the information going through it is not valuable. It's not relevant. It's also bloated in terms of the expense. And it's only supported. The only reason the higher education system is supported in any way, the only reason it's able to continue, is because we have nothing other than essentially a version of a guild system in the United States, where to have certain kinds of jobs, you must by law have certain types of degrees. It's the only reason, right? If that one stipulation were removed, a large portion of the higher education system in the Western world would collapse. Overnight, I'm snapping my fingers, that fast. It would collapse. It is only supported artificially by certain laws, legal stipulations that allow them to exist and that force you, the consumer, to have to spend $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 or more to get a degree that otherwise would be valueless. All right? So that counts as fake. That's fake education. We have, fake music, corporate-owned, created music. I mean, there's actually very few people writing most of the popular music that's out there, from whether, you know, whether it's Katy Perry or Lady Gaga or any of these other people out there. They're all under control of a very few corporate players who have writers. That's why the music all sounds the same, guys. They're all being written by the same people. It's all corporate. We have fake food. Let's not forget that, with because people increasingly don't want to cook for themselves anymore. So they buy packaged foods, frozen meals, refined grains, stick margarine. They throw it in their food, processed meats, soda. Oh, my God. That alone. I once met a man. I'm going to tell you this story. I met him maybe 15 years ago. I was doing professional resumes pretty much more or less full time at that point. I think I was in the UFO field, but I was still trying to support myself, right? Guy walks into my office and looked like he had melted. He actually looked like he had melted. Turns out he had been very, very heavy and had lost a huge amount of weight. And he said, yeah, I lost it the easiest way as possible, just sitting on my butt doing nothing. Well, he laughed, but turned out that this man had multiple sclerosis. He was in a very bad way. He said to me that he drank, I almost couldn't believe this, 15 or more cans of soda every day. I said, man, are you kidding me? God. He said, God's honest truth. He said, I worked in a warehouse. I was constantly bossing people around. I always had a can of soda every moment of the day. I was drinking it down. So when you think about the amount of empty calories that is, you're talking pounds and pounds of empty calories every single year. And those are calories that provide no nutrition, zero nutrition. All right. If you even have one can of soda a day, just one a day, that's 160 empty calories. That's a pound of empty calories, more than a pound per month. You're going to have about 15 empty pounds of calories per year just with one can of soda a day. Then you can say, well, I'll just have the aspartame and I'll go calorie free. Well, you're not helping yourself. That stuff gives cancer to lab rats. But thanks to Donald Rumsfeld, he got that stuff passed through the FDA back in the 1980s. Thanks a lot, Rumsfeld. Listen, the point is this. You want real food? Cook for yourself. Buy actual food. Go through the work, go through a little bit of effort, and cook your own food. You'll be happier in the long run. Everything around us is fake. And it's not just the food. It's not just the education. It's not just the news. It's not just our money, which is based on a really sketchy fractional reserve system, which I'm not going to get into that this episode, but I'm going to get into it, promise you. We have fake history that's being falsified and concealed all the time. Propaganda. We're in the Orwellian world. It's here, guys. Fake communities, where social media often counts as something real, replacing tangible human interaction. And then we have fake culture. Let me ask you a question, all right? You think of culture as a natural creation of the people. Well, I suggest you think again. In earlier years, it is possible to say that culture was more or less an expression of what we might call popular will. Although even then, centuries passed, millennia passed, you could easily argue that culture was still even then hierarchical, controlled by a hierarchy that dominated what was allowed to be said publicly and what was not allowed to be said publicly, and therefore created much of the culture that existed, probably so. But today, hell, today we have a culture that poses as real culture. Turn on your TV, listen to your radio, turn on your Yahoo News feed or whatever. But I would suggest to you that to a large extent, and I don't know to what extent, that culture is also a top-down phenomenon controlled by the powerful for their purposes. They create our fake music. They create our fake pop stars. That's certainly true. But they, with the money, with the power, with the influence over the media organizations, have a powerful influence over the tenor of our culture itself. And I believe that is absolutely the case. How is it that we can be independent, truly independent of this hierarchy? The only way is just to keep waking up every single day. You can't just wake up one time. It doesn't work like that. I wish it did. I wish it was just one red pill. You have to be red pilled every day. You have to remind yourself every day that you're in this situation or you fall right back to sleep. We have fake events. There's false flags happening all the time. I think the so-called chemical weapons attack in Syria last month was a false flag. The more I've looked at it, the more I've concluded that was a false flag. Anything having to do with the nefarious, disreputable white helmets, the so-called self-styled Syrian civil defense group, should always be taken with deep suspicion. And indeed, they are the source of the claims of a false flag attack, of a chemical weapons attack in Syria. And by the way, all the images of the white helmets going to save the victims of this chemical weapons attack without gas masks, without equipment. Seriously? I'm now understanding researchers aren't able to find names of any of these victims anyway in any of the hospitals. Well, I'd like to see some follow-up on that. What actually did happen in Syria that justified President Trump illegally bombing that nation, which is, by the way, fighting the Islamic State and is the only secular force on the ground fighting the jihadists in their country, just saying. Fake news, fake events, false flags, fake reality. Those of you gamers out there into VR, virtual reality, AR, augmented reality. Look, I mean, all right, I haven't done augmented reality. I haven't played virtual reality games, and I'm sure it's addictive. I'm sure it's fun. But here's the thing. In a world where hope, again, is being scooped out from right before your eyes, it's not hard to see why people would be encouraged to get into gaming, why they would be encouraged to get into virtual reality scenarios and augmented reality. Because, hell, the actual reality really is not that fun and not that hopeful to some people, right? So it's very easy. It's like the new drugs, which, by the way, that's our fake health, is our pharmaceutical industry with the drugs. Just steer you away from what's actually happening. Medicate you. Drugs in the water, drugs prescribed to you. We have a massive legal drug problem that is bad and getting worse every year. I mean, holy smoke, we're going to have fake people in the future with genetic modification down the road. What? In such a world. I mean, it is really unbelievable. I mean, every society has its problems. I'm having fun these days reading an old history of the Dark Ages. I do this type of thing at night. It's fun for me. It takes my mind off of some of the other problems of today. But it also gives me perspective. And I will say, history of the distant past was brutal and not fun. Treachery galore, cruelty, no limit to it. Human society has always been a really difficult scenario. It's always been a difficult prospect for people to live through. And in many ways, we have it vastly better today. Vastly better. No question about it. I mean, I know this. I'm a 21st century American. Compared with other people of the past, are you kidding me? I've got it great. I fully realize that and I'm grateful for that fact. However, we have our own issues. And one of the issues we're having is that we're increasingly moving into a world that where everything is pseudo. Everything is posing as real when it actually isn't real. Maybe some people don't care. Like Cypher in the Matrix didn't care. He wanted to get back to the blue pill and live his fun fantasy reality, his fantasy world. And that could very well be, because maybe for a lot of people, it doesn't matter what is true so much as just, are they happy with what they've got? And, you know, that's fair. I don't want to take that away from people. But for myself, that would not be satisfying to me, knowing that I'm living in a virtual reality. For me, I need the real thing. So for those of you who care, as I do, that about this thing called authenticity, I would just say, look, there's no easy way out of this except by making a daily commitment to doing your best not to live a fake life, to think about living an authentic life. This isn't – what you've got right now is not the dress rehearsal. It's the real deal. You're in your life right now. You are in the real thing. This is your life. So don't mindlessly throw it away for all the fakery around you. If there's one thing I really learned over the last decade through a long, slow train wreck of a personal life that was just getting worse and worse and worse, the thing that I learned was through Zen philosophy, which taught me no matter how bad things may seem, at least it's the reality. And that reality itself, no matter how awful it may feel to you, is still actually a great gift. It's still kind of like a miracle. You've got it. And you've got this beautiful gift, this thing called your life. And what are you going to do with it? Are you just going to spin out into fantasy land every day, pretending to live when you're actually not? Dealing with all the fake things as if they are real? Or are you going to confront the reality around you for all of its messy impossibilities, for all the difficulties that it confronts you with, but at least it's the real thing? I mean, for me, it's a philosophical question, and that's where I come down on. I want the reality. I don't want the fakery. And I don't say this to knock anyone who prefers the other alternative. They can like what they like, and they're entitled to it. I'm just speaking to those of us who do care about what is real and what is fake. I don't like being lied to by my government or by my society. I like to peek around and figure out what is real. That's me. That's why I do the things that I do. And that's why I'm hoping once in a while you'd like to take the ride with me. So I'm at the bottom of the hour. I cannot believe that we've gone through three quarters of the program. So I'm either going to talk about rigging elections or future privacy. And I think I'm going to talk about rigging elections in the next half hour. But we'll see. Depends on how I feel. But right now I'm out of time. I'm at the bottom of the hour. I am Richard Dolan. You are on KGRA, and I will be back in a few minutes. Thanks a lot. Hi, welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan. So the secret space stuff's not going to go away. I want to just give an online, on-air greeting to Bill Ryan. I mentioned him earlier. I've always had a great deal of respect for Bill, and a message that he wrote was basically forwarded to me. And I would like to read this on the air. I respect him enough. I want this to be out there. So, Bill, Ryan said he was listening very carefully to what I had to say earlier, and he thanks me for my kind words to him. And he said he agreed with me about the personality thing. Kudos, he's right with me. But he adds, it's about more than critiquing individually presented claims. He writes, there's a high-level campaign here, and we have to be thinking about this from the point of view of an enemy general wanting to lay waste to the community, not a maverick individual who's decided on his own to lay waste to it. He goes on and says, it's likely to be being orchestrated and planned. And if it is, we're going to be crushed underfoot as a research community unless we get smart and aware quite quickly. The good researchers are in danger of being marginalized. He finally just adds, I totally know what Richard means and admire and respect it, but when we're merely critiquing individual claims, we are also only focusing on individuals, just in a different way. So I think that's well said. And I think it's important, actually, that one of the things we have to be looking at is whether or to what extent we can determine such claims are being orchestrated from beyond. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to. It's possible to know if these individuals that are out there are being orchestrated from some entity behind them. I don't rule any of this out. If I were on the dark side and I were in charge of maintaining secrecy on the UFO subject, I would definitely want to create dissension and disunity and lay waste to the UFO research community such as it is. I would want to do that. In fact, look, we know this is precisely what the United States intelligence community has done to other countries. In my studies of false flags and color revolution phenomenon, you know, for example, the U.S. ambassador to Syria back in 2006 was talking about starting rumor campaigns among Shiite and Sunni Muslims in Syria to create sectarian strife. And in fact, the United States was working the exact same game in Iraq a couple of years earlier in 2004 and 2005 under the nefarious U.S. ambassador John Negroponte. In other words, you start rumors, you sow dissension, you create strife, and you disarm a community that way. The FBI, in its infamous COINTEL program of the 1950s and 60s, did precisely the same thing. They did it to the Black Panthers. They did it to Students for a Democratic Society. They undermined active, viable organizations that were working for progressive change, and they destroyed them. And one of the ways they destroyed them was by orchestrating behind the scenes a campaign of undermining and getting people to fight each other and creating fake stories and fake rumors and so forth. So this is something that the United States intelligence community has a history of doing. And I think Bill is right. We do need to be mindful of this type of thing happening here. Having said that, I will continue to maintain those researchers who are out there on the pro or con side who are doing their work with good intentions are people that I do want to maintain good relations with. We are in this together. We can be critiquing each other. But I'm interested in those people who are actually out there trying their best to get to the bottom of this. So I'll just leave it at that. Final segment, I want to talk about this whole rigging elections nonsense. It's actually not nonsense. You know, when I was advertising this show for this evening, one of the statements I wrote was, rigging elections, that's our job. And indeed, it is not the job of Russia. It is a job of the United States to rig elections. This is such an old story. All of this nonsense about the Russians throwing the election for Trump. I got two words for these people, Seth Rich. And if you don't know who Seth Rich is and you're talking about Russian influence, then shame on you. You have every right to be ashamed. You ought to be ashamed of yourself for being so ignorant. And learn who Seth Rich was, learn why he was murdered last summer, and then come to me and talk about Russian influence in our elections. All right. What I would like to point out is that while there is zero evidence that has ever been presented of Russian interference in our elections, despite what the liars at the CIA have said, because they've still provided no evidence. All right. Despite that, there is overwhelming, overabundant history of known instances in which the United States has rigged elections. I mean, what's galling to me, what's funny to me, is like, this is exactly what the United States does do all the time, nonstop, has never stopped, will never stop, as long as the United States is structured the way that it is, as basically the dog that's got to pee on everyone's tree in the neighborhood. As long as that's the case, this will continue. For instance, the rigged Italian election of 1948, when the United States was in terror of a left-wing victory and communism sweeping across Europe. All right, I get that. There can be a fears of the Russian tanks rolling across Europe. Of course, it didn't happen. So what the CIA did, with Nazi money, by the way, is they spent about equivalent of one – no, they spent exactly $1 million in 1948. That's equal to about $10 million today. May not sound like a lot of money, but in Italy of 1948, that went a long way. They flooded the radio airways. They funded the publishing of books and articles and published forged letters, all to smear the left organizations in Italy to have the right center party elected, and they succeeded. They got it done. That was a nice lesson learned. Then you have Operation Ajax from Iran from 1953, where Mohammad Mossadegh, president of Iran, classic type of a leader of a developing nation, basically pushing through at that time popular progressive reforms, land reforms, social security reforms, all of these things. Then made the mistake of trying to audit the oil industry, which was owned by the Brits. They basically said, up yours, we're not having you audit anything. The Iranian parliament nationalized the oil industry. That's when CIA and MI6 got involved to organize a coup. Eisenhower and Churchill signed off on this. You see explosions killing people attributed to communists and loyalists. These were all done by CIA agents. You have demonstrators who were bribed and bussed in, including violent thugs. Some of the worst Iranian Persian criminals were brought in. Hundreds of people died on the day of the coup in the streets, all promoted by the CIA. It was successful. They brought in Nazi collaborators into the new government with massive, unbelievable bribes to key individuals to run the government. That was Operation Ajax, 1953. 1 year later, you have the Guatemalan coup, 1954, a country that had basically been owned by a company called United Fruit. And again, the same story. Popular reforms by the government gets the CIA all over their case, the Arbenz government of Guatemala. CIA planted Soviet weapons in the area and led to all these fake discoveries. They bribed Guatemalan officers to participate. They set up radio stations posing as rebels. Hundreds of planted articles in the foreign press stoking the fear of communist Guatemala, while the CIA trained and armed a little couple of hundred strong military force, totally intimidated the government and military when they chased them from power. Well done, guys. Through the 50s and 60s, I mean, there's too many to go over. In the country of Laos in Southeast Asia, the CIA did about roughly one coup per year up until the early 1970s to nullify every single election that happened in Laos. By the way, the U.S. eventually dropped more bombs on Laos than all of the U.S. bombs dropped in World War II. 25% of Laotians at one point became refugees, a lot of them living in caves, all during the 1960s. That's the U.S. policy there. In Haiti, the U.S. brought in dictators like Papa Doc Duvalier with his wonderful Tonton Macoutes, the machete-wielding terrorist who killed about 100,000 Haitians during the 1970s and 80s. That was all U.S. orchestrated. We know what they did in Cuba with the Pay of Pigs. We know that they murdered or had murdered Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, a man who was truly a great leader of his country, murdered in an orchestrated effort by the CIA. They took him down. Within a couple of years, Congo was run basically out of the personal bank account of Joseph Mobutu Sese Seko, CIA man who handed his whole country over to the Western diamond miners and gold miners and so forth. Of course, he got his cut. Ecuador, Dominican Republic, Vietnam, Brazil, Indonesia, all in the early 60s, what you see are CIA backing military coups against governments that either are either too independent or promoting popular reforms that cannot be allowed. In the case of Brazil in 1964, I mean, they brought in one of the worst governments in South America in years of brutal dictatorship. Indonesia, 1965, they overthrew an elected government, the Sukarno government, in a coup because this guy had declared neutrality in the Cold War. God forbid. He had a successor, General Suharto, who massacred up to 1 million civilians, with many names, by the way, supplied by the CIA. Now, you may say, well, that's all ancient history. That was the 1960s. We don't do that now. Baloney. We don't do that now. Of course we do. All through the rest of the 60s, into the 70s, the Pinochet coup in Chile in 1973, orchestrated by CIA. I mean, hell, I'll even blame the rise of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia on the CIA, because after all, it was the CIA in 1970 that overthrew the popular Prince Sihanouk, who had kept Cambodians out of the Vietnam War. He was replaced by a CIA puppet named Lon Nol, who entered the war immediately. Bad idea. Stupid idea. Greatly strengthened the opposition of the Khmer Rouge, who, of course, were crazed, murderous thugs and murdered much of the country when they took power in 1975. But you could really say that was that would not have happened without the CIA. And through the 70s and 80s. I mean, Australia. The government of Australia, 1975. Okay, this wasn't a military coup, but this was the CIA, essentially a CIA coup of Australia. All right, the CIA pressured a man in Australia named John Kerr, K-E-R-R. He had the position of Governor General of Australia. And if you're an American or you're not Australian, you don't know what this is, but this was largely a ceremonial position appointed by the Queen. And the Governor General in the Constitution has the authority to dissolve the elected government. And in this case, the CIA leaned on John Kerr, who was very close with CIA to begin with, and they got him to dissolve the elected government of Australia, left-leaning government that shocked Australians. They're like, what the heck just happened? Well, that's what happened. That's what happened. All right. All of the criminal nonsense that the CIA organized in Central America during the late 70s, early 80s. I'm not even talking about Afghanistan and in Asia, where the CIA, of course, completely undermined that society. But I'm talking Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, Panama, Haiti, again, through the 80s. The CIA was all over these countries. And not just overthrowing governments, but promoting torture and death squads. So that's what the United States does. Now, I want to point out, in the mid-70s, there was some backlash against this type of clearly high-handed and often evil machinations by the United States, and particularly by the CIA. You know, it was in the mid-1970s that the U.S., for its only time in history, had a genuine investigation of the intelligence community, so-called Church hearings in the U.S. Senate, led by Senator Frank Church. And as a result, this was where Americans started to learn that, oh my God, the CIA actually does try to assassinate foreign leaders, and we overthrow governments, and maybe they even killed Kennedy. All of this came out. And so it was a very big embarrassment to the United States government, which eventually led to a policy change using what we might call soft power a little more effectively to create regime change, less overt emphasis with the CIA. What you ended up really seeing, this transition started in the 1980s. You might say 1983 with the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED, which is a major funder of NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Officially speaking, to this day, their policy is to strengthen democratic institutions around the world through non-governmental efforts. What that means basically is they do what the CIA previously did. And in fact, the first president of the NED was a man named Alan Weinstein, and he said explicitly, quote, a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. What it really meant is that the NED and the U.S. NGO system now, non-governmental organization system, simply serves as a front for CIA activities. And they're almost all of these are U.S. government funded. This is when we start getting into the current spate of color revolutions around the world, regime change that are being funded by NGOs, promoted by organizations like the White Helmets, which I mentioned a little while ago in Syria. All of these NGOs, I just want to point out to you in the U.S., there's a bunch of them that get funding from the National Endowment for Democracy. They're all neocon organizations. So we're talking Freedom House, and we're talking the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, that's NDI, the International Republican Institute, IRI, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, that's IFES. And there's others. There's Freedom House, and there's a bunch of these others. And they are all within the rubric of the National Endowment for Democracy, which helps to fund them. They get funding from private groups like Soros Foundation and the Koch brothers and a group called the Whitehead Foundation and the Olin Foundation and all these others. So they're all neoconservative empire builders, and they're all neoconservative and neoliberal globalists. That's their philosophy. So it's all about promoting a particular vision of what the world is supposed to be. And they're all staffed, by the way, by experts in political warfare and diplomacy and propaganda. They often include members of the CIA or, quote, former CIA personnel and military intelligence, influential political people, Democrat and Republican Party, news media. They're all involved in these NGOs, all right? These are not simply like, your friendly do-gooder next door who wants to make the world a better place. These are professionals working for the system, and they have a definite agenda. They often include representatives in major finance and oil and defense corporations as well. This is a very I've really been trying lately to figure out the structure of how this works and the funding. And, you know, the whole system of indirect revolution really, you might say, got started with the truly criminal destruction of the nation of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Now, NGOs were not explicitly involved in that, but a lot of other trial runs were being tested in the destruction of Yugoslavia, and it worked. What you really saw was the justification of NATO after the end of the Cold War. That is one key reason why Yugoslavia was destroyed. The other key reason is that it was the last standing socialist country in Europe and just had to go away. And it did go away. There's a lot of myths versus reality with Yugoslavia. And I think I would enjoy coming back in an episode to talk about that with you. I think it would be worthwhile to deconstruct the lies, I mean the awful lies that the world was told about Yugoslavia and why it was actually dismembered as it was. But what you see in the aftermath of that is the maturation of the U.S. regime change system. You know, so rigging elections, hell, how about overthrowing entire governments and destabilizing entire societies? Does that count? Because the U.S. did that in the nation of Georgia in 03, 04. They did it in Ukraine in 05. They did it in Kyrgyzstan in 05. They've done it. They tried doing it in Iran in 09. It didn't quite work. The so-called Green Revolution, where you get all these Twitter bots popping up out of nowhere. All these suspicious Twitter users and talking about election fraud on the day of the election itself. Like, how is this possible? So they're figuring it out. And then, of course, with the Arab Spring in 2011 was one of the real shining moments of U.S. organized regime change, where they destroyed entire nations like the nation of Libya, a nation that will be lucky if Libya recovers in our lifetime. I suspect it will not. That was once the wealthiest nation in Africa, a secular nation where women could wear whatever they wanted, where there was university for men and women, where there was free health care, for God's sake, free housing for the homeless in Libya. And I'll tell you this, they had more local democracy than the United States has, and that's true. Yeah, they had a strong man at the top. That was Muammar Gaddafi. But Libya was a good place to live. Intelligently managed water resources, intelligently managed oil and gold. They did well, and that's why they had to be taken down. And they were taken down brutally. And this was orchestrated, not by the people of Libya. This was orchestrated by the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. State Department, major U.S. politicians, including former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, yes, President Barack Obama, yes, the crazy John McCain, crazy Lindsey Graham, and Sarkozy and Cameron of Britain, too, were involved in this nonsense. And they destroyed that nation. So let's talk about rigging elections, will we? Let's talk about regime change. The destruction of Libya is one of the greatest crimes that the United States has ever committed. It's right up there with the destruction of Iraq from 2003. It's right up there. It's a horrible black stain on American history. And it astonishes me to this day. It's been 5 years, 6 years. I hear nothing. I had no public conversation on what the United States did to that country. You had American politicians lying their asses off saying, oh my goodness, 100,000 Libyans could be murdered by the carpet bombing of Gaddafi. I have news for you. To this day, there's not one shred of evidence that Gaddafi was carpet bombing his civilians. Not one, and you go find it. If you doubt me, I challenge you to find it and prove me wrong. You're not going to find it. There's no evidence there. All right, but based on those lies, and again, suspicious Twitter accounts, YouTube accounts, Facebook accounts, fictitious websites proven to be made in the United States in Ohio as a 501(c) organization posing as Libyan websites. This happened. All right, all of this was orchestrated, and the hysteria got going. And NATO instituted a no-fly over Libya that meant that Libyans couldn't fly, NATO could fly, and they destroyed the Libyan Air Force, and that's what destroyed the country. NATO, U.S. actually flew in the rebel leader who'd been living in the U.S. for 20 years. The CIA had funded this guy. His name was Khalifa Haftar. They flew him into Benghazi in the first month of the riots and protests, which were all violent on the side of the protesters, by the way. So that's Libya. So that's U.S. done, and we did that 6 years ago based on lies, you know, the myth to protect civilians. The truth was all about – the truth was revealed by WikiLeaks, as if you needed the truth, if you couldn't figure it out on your own. WikiLeaks last summer released a whole cache of Hillary Clinton's emails. One of them dealt with Libya. Subject line was France's client and Gaddafi's goal. This was to Hillary Clinton. And the idea in the email was to stop Gaddafi from rolling out a gold-backed African currency that would compete with Western banks. It's as simple as that. It also talked about the French desire to gain a bigger share of Libyan oil production. This is what it was about. And then, of course, and I'm not going to beat this one to death because I've talked about it so many times in this program, but the war on Syria by the United States, the war by the U.S. on the Syrian people. You know, the U.S. basically assumed it could play the same game in Syria that it did in Libya, and it just didn't work because the Syrian people, for a roll of the cosmic dice, have been hanging on by their fingernails and fighting for their civilization against jihadism. And they're doing it despite the fact that people like John McCain posed with the Syrian jihadists. And despite the fact that the United States lies and lies and lies again about it, those people are hanging on, and they are the heroes. So you want to talk about rigging elections? And let's not even talk about the U.S. attempts to reboot Ukraine in 2014 or the U.S. nonsense of its own elections. I mean, hell, the U.S. doesn't need Russia to rig our elections. We rig our own elections. We have a mainstream media complex that is monolithic. I saw the copy of Newsweek's issue of Madam President when they were expecting Hillary Clinton to win the election and, you know, shocked that, oh, my goodness gracious, she didn't win. And you don't have to be a Trump supporter to – and I'm not, by the way. I have a lot of problems with what he's doing. But you don't have to be a Trump supporter to recognize how unbelievably manipulative the United States media complex and political establishment was in the last election. I mean, come on. That's right there in front of you. So if we want to talk about rigging elections, this is what the U.S. does. You know, there's an old joke in the diplomatic community worldwide. Why is it that there's no coup d'etats in the United States? Answer, because there's no U.S. embassy in the United States. And that's the joke. I mean, what the U.S. embassies do in nations around the world is they orchestrate coups. They orchestrate revolution. They screw with elections again and again and again. When I hear this pontificating, this holier-than-thou preachiness of the United States the United States media and political establishment about Russia influencing our elections, I'm like, what universe do you people live in? Are you willfully that blind and that stupid and that ignorant of your own country's history? And the answer is yes, they are. It's a combination of dishonesty and stupidity. Just because someone knows how to clean up nicely on television and read their teleprompter doesn't mean that they're intelligent. A lot of those people who read the news are not that intelligent. They're not bright, but they've got one skill. It's to look good while reading their lines. Yep. And if you can do that, they put you on TV. So, where do the lines come from? Well, the lines are scripted from a hierarchy that's got an agenda. So, oh my God. You know, it's not that hard to destabilize a society. You just need a lot of money. And then you have to find your core leaders. You got to have them hire the key workers and the key trainers, and they've got to get the worker bees online to actually do the field work. You create your social media and your news infrastructure. You create your Facebook, your YouTube, all of that stuff. You have to get that ready. You create your physical infrastructure, by which I mean your shanty towns and your platforms and your banners and your signage and all of that stuff. And then you have the event. You can create the event, or you can use an event, whether it's a political prisoner or whether it's a social situation or a language issue or a race issue or culture. There's always something. You find an election that you want to dispute. You create that event. You spark the movement. And at that moment, this is the key moment to any of these revolutions. That's when you have to bring in the outside people, the public. You've got to make the public believe that there's a genuine movement going on. And if you can do that, if you can get people to fill out the streets with you, sometimes they can do this, sometimes they can't do this. But if you can do this, you give the appearance of an actual movement that generates interest. Now you're on your way. Next thing you got to do is provoke police response, which you must dutifully record for social media because you got to get that out there and to show how repressive the police are. You then, if you're lucky, you may get local politicians to support you. And if you're really lucky, international players, i.e. U.S. and so forth, and U.S. media, of course, to condemn the repressive actions of the government. That's how you can destabilize a society. There is no country better in the world at doing that than the United States government, guys. So next time you hear about rigged elections by Russia, your response is to laugh. And with that, I'm at the top of the hour. I think that's all I've got time for. I'm probably getting a little close to the bone here. So I want to thank you. This has been hopefully an interesting program for you, but it is time for me now to say goodnight. I want to thank my very good friend and producer, Race Hobbs. I want to thank the good people in the chat room. Sorry I didn't come in to say hello. And I want to thank you on the other end of the connection. I'm Richard Dolan. Looking forward to the next time. Now, stay tuned for 3 hours of Fade to Black with Jimmy Church. And remember, while we learn and grow and search for the truth in everything that we do, let's be kind to each other. Good night.